I'm excited about this, this international conversation that we're going to have here. So welcome, I know we laughed about this, but welcome Gunnlaugr to the Leaders Who Care series.
Thank you so much.
All right. Nice to now, be here. From now on, it'll be G, but I had to get that off my chest to put it out there. So I'm excited for you being here and sharing all the good stuff you're doing and telling a little bit about your story and how you got here. So first of all, also shout out to Thomas Reeves for the intro. Want to make sure we give him his time and everything. Great, you know, great guy. And you know, my daughter-in-law is from Denmark too. And it seems like I'm surrounded by Danes all over the place right now, which is a good thing. So could you please introduce yourself? Not yet the business part, but just tell us a little bit about where you are, where you're from, family, your favorite color, maybe something okay. You never told anybody in the world and you want to do it now, stuff like that.
Okay, well, you know, my full name is Gunnlaugr Pétur Erlendsson, which is unpronounceable, so everyone calls me G. And I'm originally from Iceland. I live in London for the last 20 years. So before that, I lived in New York and also in Belgium and a brief stint in Australia. I've kind of been traveling for the last 27 years, I would say, or thereabouts. And of course, my passion is to change things for the better. And ultimately also, you know, in terms of my favorite color, it's probably is green, like Kermit the Frog. It's not easy being green, but it's beautiful. So ultimately, of course, that's kind of like what I stand by.
Cool. Well, you mentioned Kermit, so I'm going to ask you then, what were you like as a kid? Did you watch Sesame Street and stuff like that? Or were you interested in conservation? Were you on the debate team? Because I know you did law. We'll get into that in a minute. Did you play sports? Did you like cars? What were you about?
Well, actually, yeah, I did. I was raised up in Iceland and we, of course, got television, but not on Thursdays. So when I was a kid, we didn't get TVs on Thursdays or July. So it was an interesting place to live in the 80s, early 80s. So I did watch a lot of Sesame Street and Kermit was definitely my favorite. In terms of sustainability, of course, I came to this industry, which we haven't mentioned yet, but I came to this industry.
I'm still trying to figure out what you were like as a kid, not the industry.
Well, you know, I was always creating things. I was building. I was a Lego addict. So I was always building thing, and I was a twin. So I had a copy of myself, which was great for spare parts and for in conversation because he couldn't like leave anywhere. So we had a great, we were the terrible twosome. And our parents were airline people. So we traveled the world. I was in winter, my mother would go to the south like the birds and she would flock to Florida. With my father in tow, and because my mother was a tanaholic, so she couldn't survive without being basically burning or crispy at any occasion, and so we were kind of dragged, and a lot of our upbringing was actually in the United States as a result of that in the early 80s and you know and into kind of like the early 90s.
That's pretty cool. You know, I lived in Florida for like 22 years myself out of Canada. So I went from Canada to Florida. You went all the way from Iceland to Florida and stuff. And that's pretty interesting and great opportunity for a young person to travel like that and see different things. And the Lego that always seems to come up as a building block, if you will, for young kids. Tell us a little bit about your journey. I know part of your education, not your full, was law. NYU, you've been involved in really diverse stuff, international business. Your volunteer experiences were really cool. You speak multiple languages. Share with us a little bit about what you were envisioning through that whole journey.
Well, I became a lawyer because I wanted to become a diplomat because my grandfather was one of the first diplomats in Iceland when we became independent. My uncle was also an ambassador. So it was like the third generation diplomat in the family. So I went to NYU. I graduated from law school, a master's degree there. I qualified as a New York lawyer. And then I kind of came back to Iceland, sat for the exam out of like 100 plus people, four of them got selected. I was accidentally at the top of the list. And they offered me the job. And it's interesting. As soon as you got the dream you had when you were a kid and you'd kind of been targeting, you know, almost 20 plus years of your life, suddenly you got this dream and you've achieved the success you want in life. And then you kind of realize, okay, that's great. I managed to climb the mountain, but now there are bigger mountains I'd like to climb. So actually, I was the only one who ever got the admitted into the program of the Foreign Office in Iceland and turned them down on the same day. So I've actively walked out of the door not knowing what I should be doing at all, having, of course, abandoned my childhood dream of becoming a diplomat. And I immediately moved to Belgium, where I worked at the European Commission for a while. And then I basically ended up in private equity and venture capital in London following that, accidentally with too many law degrees. So, and out of that, eventually I was doing a lot of deals, opportunities, innovation, and suddenly something appeared.
So what is it? It's amazing. You know, I got my CPA, and then once I got it, I realized I didn't want to do that either. But it was a good foundation for business, but I didn't want to do it. And even though I went to Deloitte and everything, so side story, but there's some similarities there. What was it that made you not want to proceed with being a diplomat in that arena?
Well, I had already then lived in New York for a couple of years, and of course, becoming a diplomat was very prestigious in Iceland, but I felt actually by the time I had actually achieved it, I thought maybe it was a quite limited role in the sense that it's not really much innovation you can put into it. I mean, effectively, you're towing the political line at any given stage, whoever is in political power at that given moment. So I felt potentially that it was a little bit of a restrictive role, although very prestigious. Right. And I was, you know, very happy, of course, to achieve the level. And it wasn't really until the last minute where I thought to myself, is this what I really want? And is this the path I want to go on? So instead, I just moved on to other things.
So were you obviously there was something there. I like to try to find the threads from kids to where people are now. Something there that you maybe thought this was a good foundation, but you wanted to make a bigger impact in one way or another. And then you went into deal making, all that. Were there any, when this evolved for you, were there any one or two endeavors you could share that continued that thought process, that experience of I can make a difference, you know, in business?
Well, I had been a bit like a potted plant all my life because I traveled so much when I was a kid. So, you know, shooting down roots maybe was also a bit of a challenge. And it wasn't really until I came to London and moved here that I actually started to establish some proper roots. And I've actually been here now for over 20 years. And I think, you know, New York was great and other places were fantastic. But I think, you know, London is definitely my home. And I think in this vibrant ecosystem and going through some number of changes, wherever I see innovation, it gets me excited. Wherever I see these opportunities to do something differently, to put put a dent in the universe, ultimately that felt really, really as a giving thing for me back personally. And so far, it's really the energy of the various people and talents that if you open yourselves up to the universe in that regard, you just get a flood of positivity. And of course, I've never really set myself up to do something that's simple. And as a kid, I would constantly push myself to try new things and do new things. And I was if someone said it couldn't be done, I would always try to prove them wrong. So that's really kind of where I ended up today. Still proving that things can be a lot better and we can push ourselves harder if with, you know, with hope and optimism as well.
Yeah, right on the money. No, we founded our firm, Fifth Element, on the premise and the foundation that leaders can do way better in business and for their communities when they're doing good at the same time, they're making a difference at the same time. So that's why I like to find out, you know, if that's the why you took the path that you saw and you weren't as restricted as you thought you were going to be. You could make a bigger impact in getting into other things. Just really quick, what type of deals before we get into the highlight of this, what type of deals were you involved in? Were they in?
They were in various different industries. I mean, these were private equity transactions. I was working for some high net worth individuals and helping them basically put deals together. And often enough, you know, these were deals themselves that, you know, had never been done before. And often I was really keen on finding new ways to get something through the eye of the needle, often in terms of deal terms that, you know, putting new structures in place or thinking outside the box often led to a positive success. But, you know, speed of execution is also key. The opportunity is only there for a moment. So you have to grab it by the horns and then drive the speed for adoption, because time is also an enemy, you know. And so you have to, of course, be confident in what you're doing, see the opportunity quickly enough, and then move on and deliver effectively the impact that it can achieve. Because too many ideas are great on paper, but without good execution and good timing, they're worthless. You can pour as much money into them as you want, but they just won't happen. So I think it's a combination of finding those opportunities, and the deals often were these transient opportunities that, you know, they would be, you know, a moment in time where you had to basically, you know, see exactly what can be achieved with the resources you have. And that's always been the exciting part, is when you see something that others don't maybe see often, or in a way from an angle that hasn't been perceived before.
Yeah, it's interesting. I can see how you could be impatient in working in anything government based on that, especially diplomacy, which is obviously very valuable at times, but it could also be too slow for what the toughness of you're talking about. Yeah.
It's a very noble profession and a very worthwhile profession, I want to add, but perhaps I'm just too high geared for it.
Yeah, maybe. You know, the fourth industrial revolution was designated for basically technology, AI, you know, AR, VR, you name it. But the fifth has really been more about humanity, and in the sense of how do we better ourselves in all different ways using technologies that are there and not vice versa. We do that all the time at our firm, you know, showing the combination of impact and talent always come together. So share about the innovative leadership at Enso that you're doing now. First of all, where did the idea come to you, the name? And then I got some other questions to go, but let's start with that.
Of course. So, Enso kind of got born over a series of events. Eventually, I was once asked to help out in a deal in the tire industry, and which I did, and then I kind of stepped away for it. But as someone later said, you know, the tire industry is a tricky industry because it's very sticky. Once you understand the complex nature of it, it's a combination of art and science, and it has so many different nuances to that. But it's fundamentally a production process where basic raw materials go in one door, and within hours you have the finished product, which can be equipped onto a vehicle. And so when I was exposed to this industry, which is a hard industry to enter, to be honest, I thought it was fascinating because of its complex nature. But of course, at the same time, there were other flows happening. This is in the early 2010s when I was first exposed to it. And within about 5 years from having had that exposure, Enso kind of came out of it as out of the seed. And really, the Enso, which basically is developing better tires for electric vehicles to extend range on one hand, making tires more efficient and reducing tire pollution, reducing air and microplastic pollution from tires, was really born out of the fact that at this point in time, we realized that not only, and this is of course within the tire industry, although it's not generally spoken, is that tires generate a lot of pollution. They wear out too quickly. They're often made out of inferior raw materials. And both the companies that make the tires, there are basically five companies in the world that make almost half the tires on the planet, and there's like a million companies that sell them. So both of those, the manufacturers and the distributors, they both want to sell more tires. And if they want to sell more tires, they don't want them to last too long, and they don't want to spend more really to make them any better than they absolutely have to. So Enzo was kind of born out of this frustration in the saying, look, we can definitely do better to tackle the externalities of the tire industry, of which there are many. And I could probably talk for several hours about the impact of tires in air pollution, carbon emissions, waste, toxicity, microplastics, etc. I mean, there is almost no space within the industry where you don't have some sort of a harmful impact on the environment. But, you know, we had this moment in time back in 16 where we just had Dieselgate. Dieselgate had kind of shown that the hand of the automotive industry wasn't as clean as they pretended. We also had the advent of electric vehicles, on the other hand, showing the electric vehicles were not just a flash in the pan thing. They were here to stay. But already there was within the entire community discussion about, yes, they're heavy, they have high torque, they tend to wear out tires even faster. So they're kind of calling out for a better solution than the mainstream tire companies are willing to deliver. So we then looked at this from a basically on the first principle basis, like if we wanted to build a tire industry for the 21st century focused on advancing and making electric vehicles more successful, then the question is, how do we then do that? And the answer really became, well, it's not just enough to make better products, which we do. We make them more efficient, more durable, but also about changing the business model of the tire industry. And when we make a better product, but we sell it directly to the customer, certain things happen. And the fact that the main thing happens is that we can make these tires, even though they're better and more expensive to make, we can make them more affordable for the end customer to buy.
Right.
So, you know, we have been able to show through a vertically integrated model, just like Tesla is a vertically integrated EV company, that the future can be better, particularly for electric vehicles, where we focus our attention, although the technology is adaptable to any other tires as well. We just choose to focus on electric vehicles because of that additional need that they have. And so Enzo kind of came from that basis, make a better product, provide it directly to customers to make it more affordable, and also then look to change the industry from within, because surprisingly, we have a lot of support from within the tire industry to actually make this change happen. And it isn't the case, like some people think, that the tire industry is actually against all of this innovation from happening. What they can't do is make it work as financially successful because of how the industry has engineered itself over 100 years. Remember, we had tires before we had cars.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I remember also when I wasn't around at the time, but the history says that when cars came out, people were getting killed on the street, and they tried to ban cars after that because this new invention was killing people on the street, but they weren't used to cars. So there's always somebody that says no to things, no matter what. It's interesting because I worked with people that have been involved in the recycling of tires. And like you say, the waste and the pollution, everything is horrendous. What goes on with that. And so are the tire companies competitors now, or are they, you know, jumping in the game, or what does that look like?
Well, it's just like you need, I mean, we had electric cars before we had Tesla. We just didn't have them successful at scale.
Mm-hmm.
And Tesla effectively entered the market with a vertically integrated model, selling its vehicles directly to customers, because they realized that that was the only way to make the product successful while being making it affordable to the customers as well. And very quickly, they moved on being, of course, the smallest car company on the planet to being the most profitable one.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting situation in the sense that Tesla as well is a technology-based company that, just like us, is reliant on innovation and data to drive the movement of improvement and reducing carbon emissions and tailpipe entirely by just simply removing the tailpipe altogether. But it really is the business model that allowed that to happen. And it's very hard for the big tire companies to switch to that kind of business model, because they are serving, of course, several, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of customers a year. So you have a situation that right now the tire industry makes 2 billion tires a year. That's 2 billion tires every single year. If you stack them up in a pile, you can climb to the moon. So that gives you a kind of perspective on the sheer scale of it, but it gives also a perspective on the raw material consumption.
Yeah.
Now, when these 2 billion tires per year wear down, they generate, you know, millions of tons of tire pollution, about 6 million tons of tire pollution per year. And this happens every time you accelerate, brake, turn. And it isn't just for electric vehicles, it's for all cars. And what then happens, of course, is that it becomes airborne and we're breathing it. In the UK already, I'm breathing today more tire pollution than tailpipe pollution. And that's with all the dirty cars still on the road. So when we said, well, you know, a future with electric cars that, because of the weight, would often enough develop more tire pollution because they're heavier and they have high torque. So if driven in the same ways than other cars, but with a further acceleration, you would basically not have to make 2 billion tires a year. You may in the future have to make 3 billion tires of the year. We'll be choking on tire pollution. And already the same pollution is a microplastic. So you then have the situation that the largest source of primary microplastic pollution in our oceans is tire dust. So not only is it more tire dust in the air than tailpipe dust, but it's also the most prevalent primary microplastic. So we said, look, the technology exists today to move the industry from making 2 billion tires a year to be 1 billion tires a year, simply by adopting best practices. But even so, we would only halve the problem if we did that. So ultimately, the challenge here is that although we were not able to make a tire last forever, we can make them last a lot longer and build a circular ecosystem where we not only develop the product and supply it to the customer, capture then the data from the customer to make further improvements throughout our journey as a company, but also then take those products back at the end of life and either remanufacture them or turn them into raw materials for new tires.
Right.
And that way we reduce effectively the environmental impact at every level, because the tire industry itself is, if in a nutshell, it's kind of like carbon emission, air pollution, microplastics, toxicity, and more carbon. So the scary thing for us is that if we don't kind of talk about the problem that tires cause, there's not going to be a regulation. And to date, there's very limited regulation that forces these companies to actually do anything about it.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. I don't know if this is an analogy or not, but we do a lot in ag as well. And they talk about the cows and the manure and the pollution, et cetera. And so, you know, and how that works. And you have the tires and the pollution. I'm not comparing tires to cows, but maybe I am. And at the same time, from those discussions, then comes other innovations. So for example, electric cars start. Well, how do we get better tires? How do we get this? How do we get that? How do we do EV chargers that are better, et cetera? And it grows. And, you know, in technology, there's always parallel testing if you're doing things properly. You don't get rid of the old totally and hope this works. You transition. And I'm assuming that's what would inevitably have to happen here too. And I'm fascinated by even what you said about the pollution in the ocean from the dust, you said?
Yeah, exactly. So this tire wear, the tire dust that is generated every time you accelerate, brake, or turn, we have designed cities with a perfect delivery system to take tire pollution and put it into the ocean. It's called drains. So every time it rains and the water gets into the drains, it's a jet engine to send out these microplastics into our estuaries and into our oceans. In California already, for example, now they're starting to legislate against some of the toxicity of tires. California is the first place on the planet to do that, by the way, and kudos to that. That rule came into effect 27 days ago, to be exact. Wow. It started 1st of October. And that rule basically is an attempt to try to reduce the amount of hazardous raw materials, in particular something called 6-PPD, which is incredibly toxic to salmon populations. And so there used to be on the West Coast of America these mass die-offs every time it rained. And for decades, nobody knew why. They said, look, it rains and all the salmon dies. So recently, only a handful of years ago, they identified the cause, and the cause is an anti-aging agent used often in tires to basically avoid the tire breaking down itself. But because it's a anti-aging agent, it kind of goes to the surface of the tire. It kind of migrates, and it's designed to do this, and then effectively washes off, ends up in particles that then basically, when they're washed into the estuaries, cause these die-offs. And of course, the tire industry, it's just one of many examples of where a harmfulness is already, you know, often well-known, but not addressed, because the scientists often are slow to the mark to identify these sources. Now, that is a good example of how the industry needs to change. We need to design tires that don't cause these harms. We need to be able to embrace the regulation. But at the moment, for example, there's no law anywhere on the planet against making a tire that really wears out quickly and generates a lot of air pollution and a lot of microplastics. You know, anywhere on the planet, there's no minimal durability standard for a tire. So so you could sell a very cheap, cheerful tire that has two or three or four or five times the amount of emissions than any other tire and still be legally compliant. And this is where we see, you know, the conversation needs to change.
Yeah.
We also, I mean, another funny and scary statistics is that, you know, if we switch everyone over to electric cars like that, we still have to pump oil out of the ground to make the tires for them.
Interesting. Yeah. It's, you know, it also reminds me of people that always say, well, we shouldn't go into space. We should just take care of here. Thing is, by going into space, we invent stuff that helps here. And if you're not disruptive, like you're, you know, looking at, well, electric cars are coming, which is what made, you know, companies for chargers and companies for tires also want to do something because they're looking at ways to do things. Then we start maybe uncovering stuff that unfortunately sometimes we knew about, but didn't want to do anything because of greed predominantly, of money, or we just didn't know about it and let's get on it type of thing, which is something that you're doing, which is super exciting. I didn't even understand. I didn't even know, but the drains to the ocean and the dust or things like that. I think that's, but there's so many things like that in our world that if we don't disrupt and look at things, and you know, Mother Nature probably knows about all this already and she's been trying to tell us and we don't listen to her either. So it's fantastic. I mean, there's so much more to talk about. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, from my side, you know, tires have a multiple of impacts. Not only are they born out of fossil fuels, they're built not to last very long. They reduce the range of electric cars because they're not very efficient. In America, for example, you can't know how efficient the tire is, although in Europe you can. So when you buy a tire for your Tesla, you might be losing 10% or more of your range because there's no way to tell unless you go back to Tesla and buy a set from them for $1,600. And they'll give you the tire that the vehicle originally came by. Otherwise, it's literally like going to the Wild West in the tire country.
Right.
At the end of their short life, where they generate all this air pollution, microplastic pollution, they end up in piles of waste, which often are incinerated at the end of life. They just burn the tires. And the tire industry calls that recycling. I mean, if you imagine the plastic industry getting away with saying, now we recycle all our plastics by basically putting a match to them, that's effectively equivalent to what the tire industry does today. So there's multiple things to address. But I think the one that people until recently weren't really aware of is the sheer amount of air pollution. And this is why we're really proud to be nominated now this year for the Prince William's Earthshot Prize, which announced the winner soon, and the, you know, we'll see how we go in on the 7th of November. But ultimately, of course, it's I think a very positive step that we have Prince William and the Earthshot team now highlighting tire pollution as a major problem, and particularly when it comes to air pollution, because we cannot choose the air we breathe unless we move and live on a Scottish Highland estate or something like that, far from all the pollution. The human population on the planet mostly lives in urban areas where these vehicles are driving within meters or inches, sometimes almost from your face. So ultimately, you are exposed to this, whether you choose not, try not to, or you are. So you're in a situation where we have to tackle tire pollution from an air pollution standpoint because of our human health, our kids, and also, of course, about how we want to aggregate pollution in our biosphere, because this thing doesn't go away.
Well, the thing is, you know, we have to, by the way, you stole my thunder. I was going to congratulate you on your Earth shot. So way to go. But congratulations. That's super exciting. And if we had a vote, we would vote for you for sure. The last thing I'll say on this is, you know, one thing we say in LA is you leave them wanting more so you can do a sequel. So we may have to do a sequel on this. You know, there's still people that, you know, that deny, you know, climate change and all sorts of things like that. And we need disruptors like yourself, like Elon Musk, like other people to look at things that are right in front of us that we're not looking at, that we just take for granted. So kudos to you on that. You know, I'm looking forward to, you know, putting an addendum on this for, you know, the winner of the Earth Shot prize and everything, but either way, you're really making a difference and really showing that you are a leader who cares. So congrats on that too. And I do want to ask you one last question on this part. We all remember 2020, which was the pandemic and everything. It seems like yesterday and years ago, all at the same time. And now we're already almost at the end of 2023. With everything that's happened, what are you most grateful for and what are you most hopeful for?
Well, what am I most grateful for at the moment is, of course, the nomination, because it just allows us to talk about tire pollution and address it head on and getting the exposure to a problem that nobody talks about. That is huge. That's gold dust, not just to Enzo, but for the scientists and everyone else that we are backing to really start addressing this problem, because it is a joint up effort. And of course, I'm grateful for us. We're already selling these products now here in London. We'll be opening in California next year, working with some large EV fleets to start out with, and then selling it to individual EV owners as well. So eventually any Tesla owner in California can buy a set of my tires. And I'm grateful for the fact that, you know, we've been able to show that, you know, we can make tires a lot better. We can make them more energy efficient to extend the range of your EV and save money. We can make them more durable to reduce this pollution, and we can make it more affordable than our competition as well. All of these steps have taken us years to prove, because there's a lot of doubters out there that say, you know, people cannot really change this industry. But, you know, people used to say that we can't make electric cars either. Right. So what our mission is to make electric cars more successful by extending their range and reducing the pollution that comes off their tires. We're doing both already. So I'm grateful for the fact that now we're able to basically share our journey and talk about a problem that is so urgent to be addressed and give hope and optimism that it's possible to do so.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the fact you're coming from what I initially saw, your spaceship over there, which is really, you told me, your taxi. Is that right?
Yeah, this is the London Electric Taxi. It's my mobile office as well here in the UK. And so I do a number of events, podcasts and show and tells in this thing. We're selling these tires, of course, to cab drivers and electric van fleets. And we're working with two of the largest fleets in the UK already. So, of course, the largest fleets of electric taxis as well. So it's kind of like a demonstration of our capabilities. But, you know, watch this space. There's more to come.
I love it. No, well, thanks so much for sharing all that. And like I said, being a leader who cares, and we'll be following you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.